I'm Vermont Edition producer Sam Gail Rosen. This podcast has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Lawmakers will return to the Statehouse next Tuesday to kick off the second half of the 2019 session, and the fate of many key bills will be decided in the coming weeks, including a tax and regulate marijuana plan, paid family leave, raising the state minimum wage, making changes to Vermont's tax system, and a possible four-year term for governor. So what's the outlook for these and other issues? Today we've got a group of Vermont's best political reporters to look at how the legislature might deal with these proposals. Joining us today are Xander Landon of VT Digger, John Walters, a political columnist for 7 Days, and Dave Graham. He's the host of The Dave Graham Show, heard weekday mornings on WDEV. Great to have you all here today.
Glad to be here,
Thanks,
Bob.
For
Thank you.
Let's start off and take a look at the tax and regulate marijuana issue. The Vermont Senate, just before the town meeting break, gave its strong approval to that bill. It sets up a state regulatory system really quite similar to alcohol for the sale of marijuana in retail stores across the state. Caledonia Senator Joe Benning is a sponsor of the bill. He says he views it as a consumer protection bill because it will ensure that people get a quality product, something that might not be happening now when a person buys pot on the black market.
And the larger danger in that is when they are selling that product, cannabis, they are probably also selling something else that's far worse.
Now, Senate Transportation Chairman Dick Mazza says he couldn't vote for the bill because it didn't address the issue of driver impairment.
My concern is that we have nothing in this bill to address the safety on our highways, of our police departments, and our public safety. That bothers me.
And that issue of driver impairment is a key issue because Governor Phil Scott has said he won't support the tax and regulate bill unless it includes specific provisions dealing with driver impairment.
I think that's part of where we need to go. We need to have to detect impairment on our highways and with any substance. I think it's that important. And there's no rush. And from my perspective, let's get it right. I mean, we can watch what others have done, learn from them, and do better.
So why doesn't the legislation include a roadside driver test to determine impairment based on marijuana use? Well, Senate Judiciary Chairman Dick Sear says there's a pretty basic reason.
There is no test currently available to determine whether a specific amount of marijuana or any other drug for that matter would result in impairment. For that reason, the committee chose not to include the issue of oral fluid testing.
So, Xander, what happens now? The Senate gave its very strong vote to that bill. It goes over to the House. The governor is looking at it without the driver impairment. What's your sense of what's going to happen over in the House?
Well, it certainly wasn't any surprise that the Senate was going to pass this thing very quickly. They've passed tax and regulate measures on multiple occasions. So now it heads over to the House, where until this point, tax and regulate legislation has had no real traction. This year is a little different, obviously. We already partially legalized marijuana in this state. I mean, we legalized possession of small amounts of marijuana in July. So there's momentum now for Democrats in the House to be pushing forward tax and regulate legislation. And we had Sam Young, a representative from Greensboro, has a separate bill. It's pretty similar. There's some minor differences that he says he has the support to pass. He says he has the votes. That's never been the case before. There's never been the support in the House to pass it. So what's interesting, and you know, we're hearing the sort of the debate about roadside saliva testing and whether or not there should also be a lot of money on the table to fund education prevention initiatives if we're going to legalize a market for cannabis sales. Basically, the House has a different mind about how they want to see it. They want to see they're very much more open to seeing saliva testing on the table and money for education prevention initiatives on the table and negotiating with the governor to get a bill that he's going to sign. I mean, that's basically Young told me specifically, you know, if we're going to pass this thing, we got to pass something the governor can sign. So I think we may see some negotiations and some sort of compromise there that we didn't see in the Senate.
John, it seems like we've got this catch-22. The governor wants to have driver impairment testing. Senator Scheer saying, yeah, but the test really isn't all that accurate and doesn't tell you very much. So what good is the test?
Yeah, the argument the governor makes seems to be more about delay rather than actually seriously wanting a saliva test that doesn't really work. You know, basically the back end of his quote there was, why don't we take this slow and see what develops in other states and hopefully see some sort of saliva test. Where this seems to be going, one thing I'll point out about the House, it has been reluctant to pass tax and regulate in the past, but there are 40 new people in that building now, 40 out of 150 who weren't there last year. It will be interesting to see where those new votes fall, because where this seems to be going ultimately is if it passes the House, the governor will probably veto it, and then can the House override a gubernatorial veto? That's probably where this is headed in the long run.
And Dave, there are concerns about a saliva test. Senator Sears wants to make sure there's a court order or a warrant. There's some privacy concerns here too, aren't there?
Right. Well, you can obviously a saliva test could pick up any number of other substances, some of them non-impairing and perfectly legal. You know, I'm talking about medications now that people might be on and be reluctant to share with their local police what they're taking, and that's a that is a concern. Certainly, the American Civil Liberties Union has voiced concerns about a roadside saliva test. One of the concerns is that we've talked about it not really being an effective measure of impairment, and measuring impairment with marijuana or cannabis is actually very difficult because nobody really knows. Even if you have the active ingredient of THC in your bloodstream, nobody has yet decided not just how to test for it. That's one question. But then the other question is, when you find some, what is the level that is really impairing? Does that differ from individual to such an extent that you really can't come up with a reasonable standard? And, I mean, there are just many, many sort of scientific questions behind this that make this hurdle very, very difficult. And, as John mentioned, maybe this hurdle, I mean, in the view of some, is sort of being used as a delay tactic, as a just put it off into the future because we don't have a good test.
Sander, we've got a number of states that do tax and regulate. How do they deal with it?
You know, I think that a lot of these this testing issue is the same across the country. There is no good test that tests for something beyond the presence of cannabis in one's system. I know that some states have invested in more drug recognition experts as in tandem with legalization. But I think one thing that's important to note is that, you know, we saw this sort of ideological opposition in the Senate to putting money on the table in addition to legalizing a market for things like roadside testing and education prevention. The governor's proposal, if he wants to see a tax and regulate system, would sort of necessitate a lot of money, tens of millions of dollars of investment. The Senate's saying, well, it shouldn't be up to us to say we need line item X, Y, and Z funded here. Let's let these departments, our state agencies, vie for that money in the budget process and argue for why we need money for X number of new DREs or X number of new education programs. And I think part of the issue is that the estimates for the amount of revenue that we're going to be seeing coming in from a tax and regulate market they're pretty pretty low, pretty meager. I think the conservative estimate 3 years out, 3 years into having a market for cannabis with dispensaries and whatnot would be, you know, maybe a little under $10 million. And the more generous estimate, this is according to the Joint Fiscal Office, around closer to $20 million. That's not a whole lot of revenue. So I think that's part of the issue.
And the DREs aren't really a panacea either. There's an awful lot of, frankly, scientific guesswork that goes into even things like, are you impaired by alcohol? There's a relate back rule in alcohol where if they test you, they try to calculate how drunk you were 2 hours ago when you were behind the wheel. And there was some very interesting testimony by a state chemist a couple of years ago now indicating they were going by a rule of thumb. Now, a rule of thumb is this medieval standard that really was from kind of a pre-scientific age. And all that means is we're guessing. We don't really know. We have this sort of standard that seems reasonable, but it hasn't been scientifically demonstrated at all. And many, many instances of this drug recognition expertise rely on the same sort of not very scientific standards. I know one personally, I have something called horizontal nystagmus from birth. My eyes kind of bounce back and forth some. According to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, horizontal nystagmus is a prima facie evidence of intoxication. So in other words, somebody can see me, a police officer could see me stone cold sober. I haven't had anything to smoke, drink, or whatever in months or years, and will assume I'm intoxicated because my eyes are doing what they do and have done since birth. And so, frankly, I'm quite skeptical on this front as well.
John, it's kind of interesting. Xander mentioned the money that was going to be raised with this bill. Yeah. You know, a year or two ago, people were going $50 million, $80 million, who knows, $100 million. I guess it really depends on what the tax rate is. But yeah, the Senate decided, let's not have too high a tax rate because people continue to buy from the black market.
Yeah, it's a tricky balancing act, and the administration wanted to have a higher tax rate to pay for all the programs that they think will be necessary if marijuana is fully legalized. And the feeling on the other side is that, you know, you don't want to price the legal stuff out of the market when a lot of people have dealers that they do trust, whether or not it's legal right now. Another concern, I think, about waiting is that nearby jurisdictions are moving toward legalization. And one of the things that many marijuana advocates are in favor of is developing our own strong marketplace with vendors, with growers, and all of that. And if the surrounding states move ahead of us, then the Vermont industry will have a tougher time developing.
Let's go to our callers and start off with Elise, who is calling from Greensboro. Hi, Elise. Hi. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I just want to start my remarks by saying that last summer when things got to be legal, people my age have waited 50 years to not be outlaws, and it's still hard to believe after all this time that we don't have to hide. All I want to know is, am I going to be able to grow my two plants after all this stuff has happened?
If we go to full legalization, you mean?
If we go to the tax and regulate plan?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you can already cultivate two plants under current law.
I don't see why they would restrict the ability of people to grow their own. If anything, you might be able to plant three or four plants if you wanted to.
I think I understand, though, what's behind Elise's question, which is a natural worry that if commercial interests enter in here, there may be some lobbying eventually in not too distant future to try to restrict the idea of people growing their own. And is that where you're coming from, Elise?
I could care less. I mean, the new tax money would be swell, but I'm not planning on buying it from anybody.
You just want to grow a couple of plants and enjoy getting high occasionally, right?
Yes. We can relax if we feel like it.
Yeah. It's a fairly simple process for an awful lot of people in Vermont. And so I think that your idea, you could take or leave a commercial market, I'm guessing, right?
I'm sorry, I missed that last one.
You could sort of take it or leave it on having a retail and tax situation.
Yeah, I can't afford retail.
can't afford somebody else's profit margin. Yeah,
Elise, thanks very much for your phone call. Let's turn to Kathleen, who's calling from Marshfield. Hi, Kathleen. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. My comment is about higher education funding in Vermont.
Yes. What are your thoughts?
My thoughts. Well, I'm a faculty member at the community college. I also am a faculty coach in the TRIO program, which serves low-income and first-generation students, and I'm also a member of our union. And my comment is about higher education funding, which is 50th in the country, which means we're last behind Alabama, behind Mississippi, behind everybody else. And the enabling legislation called for the state to provide major funding for the state college system, which we did at one time. It was more than 50%, and now the number is well below 20%. And so that impacts student tuition. We have the highest community college tuition in the country. This should not be. and we actually do have a really good rate in Vermont of high school graduation, but one of the lowest rates of college continuation in the region. And it seems to me that the ability to afford an education is critical to our economic development in Vermont. So there is a free tuition bill in the Senate. I understand that that may or may not be possible, but certainly our union is behind it, and we want to see something done. And our chancellor, Jeb Spaulding, is asking for us to get to the country average, which is 30% of funding. So this affects not just students, it affects our faculty as well. Our state college faculty are paid what community college faculty are paid in other parts of the country, and people in my position, community college faculty, all part-time, paid mm-hmm. even more poorly. No benefits, no retirement, no vacation, no health care. And one of my colleagues told me that she tracks her hours, and she reported that she makes $16 an hour.
Yep.
And then,
so John, you know, this is an issue that you hear a lot about at the State House. I think it's Senator Polina's bill that is the free college tuition. And mm-hmm. in talking to Senator Baruth, who is the chairman of the Senate Education Committee, he's intrigued by the idea of increasing spending. But to go to free tuition is just too big a step at this time.
Yeah, I mean, the colleges and universities in the state, it is a real problem. When the governor, when everybody is talking about workforce development, when everybody is talking about making it more possible for young people to stay in Vermont or move to Vermont, affordable tuition is a big impediment to people staying here or moving here. And it's something that we have failed to address for years and years. The governor is kind of doing a slow rollout of an idea. He calls it cradle to career, which is, taking education as meaning everything that happens from the time you're born to the time you enter the workforce. And that would be one way of giving more money to the higher education system, which needs to be done somehow. The problem is he would be taking it from the public school system, and that is politically unpopular, and he realizes that. That's not the only place you could take it from, but it is a big problem. Free tuition would exacerbate the colleges and universities' financial struggles unless the state provides enough money to make up for tuition. We shall see if that happens. But it's a big, big issue that nobody really seems to have a good solution for.
Today in the program, we're looking at the work of the legislature. They'll be back next week for the second half of the session. We've got some of Vermont's best political reporters here to talk about these issues. John Walters, a columnist for 7 Days. Dave Graham, host of The Dave Graham Show on WDEV. And also Xander Landon of VT Digger. Let's talk about paid family leave. It's a bill that conceptually enjoys a fair amount of support at the State House. But the question is, should the plan be voluntary or mandatory? Now, Senate President Tim Ash is backing the mandatory approach in order to create a large pool of participants. But Michael Pichek, who is the commissioner of the Department of Financial Regulation, says the mandatory plan could actually hurt a lot of small businesses.
One of the advantages of spreading the risk across the entire state workforce is that the contributions that each individual have to make are very, very affordable.
That's going to be difficult for them, to be able to maintain their operations, the amount of employees that they have. It certainly will make them think twice potentially about expanding or adding additional employees for some employers that can't bear this.
Now, Xander, this has been a real priority for House Democrats. It seems like the bill is hitting some rocky water right now. What's going on?
Yeah, so the bill is now in the House's tax panel, the House Ways and Means Committee, where it's sort of being questioned and prodded. What we have right now is a bill that would replace 100% of an employee's wages for, I believe it's 12 weeks. And the governor's plan, the governor also put forward a paid family leave program, which, as you suggested, is a voluntary plan. The plan that's before the House Ways and Means Committee would be a mandatory plan. There are questions about how long it would be funded through a payroll tax split between employees and employers. And there are questions about how long it would take to get the revenue needed to have the program actually up and running, whether it would take 2 years of having the tax in place before you'd be able to actually administer the program. And then there's questions of, well, what if a recession happens? Would we be able to basically administer the benefit during that time? So I think what's likely going to happen, if I had to guess, is that you're going to see the plan in that committee or in the Senate in some way before it's passed dialed back. Less wage replacement, less time offered off under the paid leave plan. And then something that's also interesting is that the governor's proposal would be administered by a third-party insurer, not the state. And there was actually talk last week or the week before about, well, why don't we think about using using that idea in the House plan? Like, why don't we have a third-party insurer think about doing that to save the cost? Because obviously administering a program through the state would cost, you know, millions of dollars. You'd need to have employees, state employees working on that. You'd have to have a way of administering the benefits. So there are lots of ideas on the table. I think, you know, the House obviously did pass this bill last year. The legislature did. The House and the Senate passed the bill, got to the governor's desk, and he vetoed it because of the payroll tax. He doesn't want to plan fund it that way. So I think we're going to see some sort of dialing back over the next few weeks. What it looks like in the end, we'll have to see.
John, can you see a circumstance where the Democrats say, because they want to get it through so badly, they go, all right, let's start with the voluntary approach. Let's try it for a year or two. And if it doesn't work, then that sort of sets up the mandatory approach.
Well, I think, as Xander said, they're looking for a middle road here. Whether they would go entirely with a mandatory plan, I do not know, especially since the foundation of the mandatory plan is state workers are enrolled automatically, and this would be a two-state plan with Vermont and New Hampshire. And the New Hampshire legislature has not looked kindly on this proposal from Governor Chris Sununu. If New Hampshire is out, then that makes the a Vermont voluntary system more tenuous and possibly less acceptable to Democrats than it is now. I think there is fiscal caution toward establishing a new program, a new benefit. I think there is also, great momentum on the parts of the Democrats. This is one issue they really want to own, and I doubt that they would settle for the Governor Scott approach.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to David, who's calling from Burlington. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much. So I'm a physician in Burlington, and I am a member of a group called the Vermont Climate Health Alliance, and we're a bunch of docs and healthcare professionals worried about the human effects of climate change. And I know that there is a bill looking at weatherization that I think is in the House right now, which this bill seems to accompany a report which just came out from the Department of Public Health in Vermont showing huge benefits financially and also in health expenditures. If we can get more funding to weatherize people's houses, especially folks who are low income. And so I was curious where that bill stands and if there are any other bills looking at mitigating the effects of climate change.
Okay, David. Dave, one thing the House Democrats have made pretty clear is they don't want to touch a carbon tax this year. They see that as really a dangerous place to go. But how about things like, you know, weatherization and credits for electric vehicles?
You know, I actually haven't followed this that closely in the finer weeds. But, I mean, again, this is one of those things that sounds like a great idea to put more funding into weatherization and try to help, especially low-income Vermonters with their heating bills by basically reducing their heating bills. At the same time, it doesn't surprise me that physicians and other health providers are interested in this as well, because obviously you need a warm place to sleep in the winter and a warm house in which to do your household things of cooking and hanging out and watching TV and whatever all the other things people do at home. And if houses are insufficiently heated or have big drafts and so on and so forth, that certainly can have a health effect. Heating systems also can be, there are some drafty old wood stoves that put out a lot of soot and smoke and stuff in interior environments, which can be a very unhealthy thing. So I understand fully that this is a key interest of health providers. Yeah, it's one of those things that is competing. I don't really feel as though the budget has really quite gelled yet, and that we've come down, push has come to shove. You know, we just heard about the higher ed system looking for a lot more funding because Vermont ranks 50th in the country in its funding for state colleges and so on. And this is another item competing, and there are several other good causes which are lined up and hoping to get increases in funding this year. It's always a little bit of a mystery until it finally happens how it's all going to sugar off.
Yeah, there's a bunch of bills that are kind of in this category of efforts to fight climate change where, as Dave said, competing for resources, also trying to balance the governor, who would not be inclined to accept any major new spending proposals. And on the other hand, you have a lot of advocacy groups saying, look, the time is now, you know, for significant action, not for just $1 million in, you know, electric vehicle credits, but for some sort of broad-based action to do our part to help the climate. And also, as David said, the investments pay off in the long run. The problem is making those investments right now.
I think it's interesting because there's obviously Democrats want to do something about climate change. There was a lot of reports that came out before the session about just how dire the situation is globally. And there was some moment. There's a lot of, you know, activists pushing for stuff, various proposals. But there really isn't a singular sort of push, a singular bill or proposal that would sort of fight climate change in sort of a clear-cut way. It's a very tough issue, especially because I think, you know, House Speaker Mitzi Johnson, for example, said she wants to do something about public transportation. I haven't really seen anything like that on the table besides the EV sort of subsidies or incentives. And at the same time, you see things going on in the Senate with them actually making it reducing the emission standards for vehicles. So I think part of the issue here is you just sort of in general is we really rely on cars here. And it's hard, you know, how could we, you know, think about public transit in this state? How could we think about doing things differently? It's hard to sort of envision that.
Let's talk to Nancy, who's calling from Manchester. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the program.
Hi, everybody. So I just want to know who's going to own this issue, water. We are in so much trouble in this state. We promote tourism. I see that we promote swimming in Lake Champlain. Oh, my God. Not me. Not my family members. What are we doing about water in this state? We just keep burying our head in the sand about it. There's a lot of people making noise, but nothing is actually really happening. Maybe I don't know what I'm talking about, but I hope we can address that.
Nancy, in all fairness, the governor has a plan. Whether or not lawmakers are going to go along with that plan is probably the $64,000 question of the second half of the session. John, if I remember correctly with the governor's plan, he wants to take the estate tax, mm-hmm. It's about $8 million, and dedicate it to water quality. He also wants to make some other changes to the estate tax to make the exemption even larger. I think he wants to take some money from the property transfer tax. And the EPA wrote a letter a couple weeks ago saying, gee, the governor's plan looks like it'll work. What's the status of all this?
Well, it is the Trump EPA. bear that in mind. I think this battle has yet to be joined, really. It's one of many. You know, I think we were talking before we went on the air about how it seems like it's been kind of a slow session. We haven't gotten to the part where they start actually, you know, getting down to the nuts and bolts. There are questions about the estate tax plan. For one thing, you're taking that money from somewhere else. For another thing, the estate tax does vary from year to year because it's collected from a small number of wealthy people. So the number who die in any given year makes a big difference. So is that a stable enough source for a long-term water quality plan? And then, you know, beyond all this, we are talking about a mitigation plan that would, if fully funded and implemented over 20 years, greatly reduce the amount of nutrients going into our bodies of water, but it would do nothing to actually, like, clean up Lake Champlain, which is already beset by a lot of toxins, a lot of nutrients and algae blooms and all that. The cleanup plan itself is really not a cleanup plan. It is a mitigation plan. So, you know, we do face a long road on this, and we are making up for decades of neglect. And that's a tough thing.
And Dave, you know, there's an interesting argument over at the State House, who should pay for this? And there, a couple of weeks ago, the Senate Natural Resources Committee chairman, Chris Bray, was looking at a per parcel fee. That was something that came up last year as well. That doesn't seem to be a popular idea over there. And is this a responsibility for the state as a whole? As Nancy mentioned, it's got to do with tourism, so everybody's got something at stake here. How do you see this getting resolved?
Well, again, it's a question of, are there revenues? Can you raise a tax to raise the needed revenues? It's like so many other programs in state government. And this idea of a parcel tax, obviously the people who have suggested it, it makes some sense. They recognize that, one of the big sources of pollution, I think of my own yard in Montpelier. Well, the runoff from my yard heads down the street toward the North Branch, which goes to the Winooski, which goes to Lake Champlain. And so, maybe I'm, one gazillionth responsible for the pollution in Lake Champlain. I suspect my dog might be. It could incentivize better conduct in terms of just getting people out there to clean their yards more regularly or whatever. But on the other hand, I think that it's a tough sell. You have a whole political party which bases its ideology on no new taxes, and that has a lot of appeal for people who are already feeling pinched financially. I don't want to pay higher taxes. I don't think anybody really does, unless they can really feel as though they're getting something valuable in return. And whether a little new parcel tax is the answer, I don't know. It's a hard sell. And on the other hand, I think most Vermonters agree that we need to do something to protect our waters, as the caller from Manchester said, because they're absolutely key to tourism. They're key to our own sense of Vermont being in a relatively pristine place environmentally. So we'll have to, like so many other things, see how it plays out.
Xander, is this an issue that can wait until next year, or do you feel like lawmakers have this requirement that it needs to be done in 2019?
Yeah, I think that certainly the Democratic leaders say that they want to do something as soon as possible. House Speaker Mitzi Johnson has repeated that this is something that can't wait. They say that, but at the same time, they're not really throwing their weight behind any particular idea. And I think that that's sort of an issue at this point. We're halfway through and there's nothing in either body. There's no funding proposal that's really gaining steam. They certainly have criticism of the governor's proposal. Like John said, they don't like the idea of taking revenue that would otherwise be going basically straight into the general fund. And the idea of saying, well, we're going to just sort of earmark $20 million every year for the next 20 years. The governor says that that money isn't going to cut programs, but they're saying, well, how can you guarantee that for such a long period of time? And yet, they're not really, they don't have a real singular alternative on the table yet. We'll have to see over the next few weeks if anything shakes out.
Today, I've got a group of reporters taking a look at the second half of the legislative session. With us, Dave Graham of The Dave Graham Show on WDEV, John Walters, a political columnist for 7 days, and Xander Landon of VT Digger. And let's talk to Richard, who's calling from Shelburne. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the program.
Great. Thanks, Bob. I'll be quick. I think you're running out of time. Two things. One, the term of the governor. I think I read a piece by you written in Google about starting the other way around by extending the term of the legislators first. And then that might turn into a more lengthy or significant discussion about extending the term of the governor. The second one, what is the status of Senator Polina's bill on revising the bottle law and getting a deposit on wine bottles? Thank you.
Two very good issues, Richard. John, the Senate government operations is usually the starting point for a lot of these constitutional amendments, and that's what the four-year term would be.
Yeah.
I don't know. I haven't seen a lot of activity in that committee on this particular amendment.
No, they're taking a slow approach, and that's they realize that it's going to be a slow approach no matter what they do, because our constitutional amendment process is so convoluted. It has to go through at least two legislative sessions. So you're talking about a long-term thing. And I think the idea there are various ideas. And again, this is a problem because what you need is clarity behind a single proposal, and everybody's got their own idea. You know, is it better to give the governor a four-year term so that the governor has more time to implement, to plan longer term and implement an agenda? Would it be better to make the state Senate four-year terms as well and leave the House as the body with the short terms? And then there's always the powerful appeal of leaving things the way they are. You know, Howard Dean, the former governor, actually likes two-year terms because he says it makes the governors more responsible to the people. I don't know. I think it would be an accomplishment if it just got out of the legislature this year. As for Polina's bottle bill, I have not heard anything about that. So I'll turn it over to the other panelists and hope they have.
Dave, you know, you look at the four-year term, and it's, as John mentioned, it gets complicated because there are some people who want a four-year term, but they don't want to change the terms for the legislature. It's hard for me to believe that the members of the House and Senate are going to support a four-year term for governor and not do something about their own terms because they're going to feel that they're giving the governor too much power.
Well, they already argue about an imbalance in power, mainly having to do with the fact that the governor is in office year-round and the legislature is really busy only in the period from January typically through May. And so there's already that calendar imbalance. And meanwhile, you know, the governor has lots of staff, all the agency heads and their staffs to research things and come up with new policies and that sort of thing, to vet ideas. And the legislature has very limited research staff. I mean, the group they do have is terrific, but it's very small and is spread very, very thin. And so there's already that sense of imbalance there. And some of it's just sort of institutional jealousy. Hey, if that guy gets four terms, I already have four-year term. I ought to have a four-year term. Frankly, I don't see much happening on this. I think that it's the kind of thing that, you know, it's an idea that pops up every now and then. There's really not a compelling enough reason, I don't think, for people to move the mountain that is passing a constitutional amendment in Vermont. And so I sort of think it's going to slide away again.
I think there's some I don't know if it's concern or just like, but maybe it's realization that Vermont and New Hampshire are the only states in the country that have 2-year terms for governor, and it kind of seems a little bit ridiculous for some that you know the governor basically has to constantly be campaigning, and governors argue that you know it makes it harder to govern if you have to be worried about you know reelection every year or. You know, the year after the second year in your 2-year term, having to worry about that constantly. So I think there is support for the idea of 4-year terms, but whether practically it gets out this session, I don't know.
It's interesting to look at past governors on this. As you mentioned, John, Howard Dean supports the 2-year term. We had a program on Vermont Edition a few weeks ago where former Governor Madeleine Keenan supported the 4-year term.
Yep.
Peter Shumlin likes the 2-year term.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Douglas thinks it's time for a 4-year term. So even our governors are all over the place.
Now, maybe it's a matter of their personality and how much they like campaigning.
Well, and also, you know, that's the thing. If there were a solid consensus of former governors that the 2-year term really doesn't work and we need to make this change, then yeah, maybe. But again, the constitutional amendment process in Vermont is such a heavy lift that I don't think without that consensus, we're going to get there. And I also think Vermont's always bragging about what a great little laboratory of democracy we are here and how we have all this access to our politicians and how wonderful that is and our town meeting tradition and all the rest of it. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of self-satisfaction out there, frankly, and and maybe the self-satisfied people don't make change that readily.
Let's talk to Mark, who's calling from Cambridge. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi there. So my issue is Act 46. I led the effort to have Cambridge vote no in the latest effort to have us swallowed up by the Lamoille North District. And mostly I led that effort because Cambridge had voted twice, the second time by even larger and wider margins, to not join the wider union. And I guess I have two questions. One is what's going on in the Senate with regard to that? And the other is why have us voting in the first place if ultimately the vote doesn't count, especially in these days where people mistakenly think that their vote doesn't count? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, Mark, thanks very much. John, this is a fascinating question over there because you've got this lawsuit sitting out there. So do lawmakers really want to make big changes to Act 46 with this lawsuit pending?
Yeah, it's a tough issue. It divides people. It splits up the parties. If you're from a district like Cambridge, you are not friendly to Act 46 because that's what your constituents want. So the votes on this tend to be very much split up, and overall the legislature has little appetite for opening this issue up. And there are a lot of complaints about it, but there is also an impetus in both parties, both major parties, to move on something that will reduce the number of school districts and presumably cut costs. We've already gone pretty far down this road. The governor is in favor of more consolidation. Act 46 was a Democratic proposal under Governor Shumlin. It's got a lot of momentum, even though lawmakers are very much aware of the fact that it has a lot of enemies as well.
Sandra, how do you see, do you think lawmakers will really try to tackle this in a comprehensive way? Because I'm not sure when the lawsuit is going to be settled. It could be this summer or spring or summer, right?
I'm not sure how that's going to sort of affect things. But I think that generally, talking to folks at the beginning, no one really wanted to change the sort of the way that things were going with mergers. And I don't really know how the lawsuit and the ruling, I think it was this week, right, is going to affect things. I think, yeah, we're going to see the proposal now in the Senate, but I don't know.
The lawsuit you mentioned was the preliminary injunction ruling, but the main ruling is still hanging out there.
Right.
Yeah, the preliminary injunction ruling, the judge ruled against the plaintiffs who wanted an injunction to stop any merger activities until the lawsuit is settled. And the judge's decision seemed to indicate that that he does not look kindly on the case of the plaintiffs, which might be a bad news, bad sign for them going forward.
And the legislature has some cover now. They can basically say, look, the judge said we're not going to delay, so we're not going to delay either.
Right.
I think that really, for folks who want to push ahead in the legislature, that helps them.
Well, a lot of issues to consider in the second half of the legislative session. We'll follow many of those. Many thanks to our panel today, John Walters of 7 Days, Xander Landon of VT Digger, and Dave Graham, host of The Dave Graham Show. Thank you all very much for coming by. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Happy to do it.